Father John A. Hardin, S.J., is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is one of a series of lectures given by Father John Hardin in Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book, Religions of the World. Father Hardin first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father Hardin is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, Buddha and the Four Noble Truths. Father Hardin.
Now, at the outset, we say that Buddhism differs radically from Hinduism in that it has a historical figure at its center. And consequently, when we talk about sacred writings, the concept of sacred takes on again another meaning in Buddhism, because for the believing Buddhist, that is sacred which Buddha wrote. Now, whether he wrote it, whether he inspired it in the sense that his followers wrote what he taught them, it does not matter too much. As a matter of fact, we have nothing that was, as far as we can tell, physically written by Buddha. No doubt he did write. He was literate. But what we have is only traditions. Traditions of his contemporaries, of his own followers, things they wrote, his sermons, his commentaries, sometimes very cryptic sayings. Much, by the way, of Buddhist sacred writing is in the form of dialogue, where Gautama, which is the more common name, or at least the more correct name of Buddha, is one part of the dialogue, and some question is the other side. The Buddhist scriptures, as they are called, have come down to us in two languages, and therein lies already the seed of the division in Buddhism. In fact, otherwise than in Hinduism, Buddhism at its very root is a divided religion, and the basis is the two sets of scriptures. The one set is written in Pali and the other in Sanskrit. Pali was the literary language similar to Buddha's vernacular. It would be as though we had our New Testament in Aramaic and in Greek. The Aramaic of Christ and his immediate contemporaries and the Greek of the learned world. Pali is no longer spoken in India, where Buddha, of course, was born. The Pali texts, those, that is, that are followed by those followers of Buddha that believe the Pali texts are authentic, are mainly read, and therefore their doctrine followed, in Ceylon, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia. You will notice we are here favoring the central, verging on the southern, southeastern parts of Asia. The Sanskrit texts are pretty much all other nations, because Buddha is all over the eastern world. Now, among the nations that are mostly affected by the Sanskrit, and these are more than versions, there are things in the Pali text you don't find in the Sanskrit, and vice versa. Not merely a difference of language. The one nation that is mostly affected by the Sanskrit type of Buddhism is China. Chinese Buddhism is Sanskrit Buddhism, and more distinctions as we go on. The Pali texts of Buddhism are older and, by all accounts, as far as Western scholars can decide, Eastern scholars don't decide. They simply act. They say, those who favor Pali, Pali alone is true. There is nothing in the Sanskrit. And the opposition, the opposite. According to Western scholars, Pali texts are the older and apparently more authentic. I believe they are right. I think, therefore, that authentic Orthodox Buddhism is Pali Buddhism. But that doesn't mean too much, because as far as antiquity goes, they are both about equally old. The canon of the Pali texts was fixed, so the Southeastern Buddhists claim, by three councils, all they further claim meeting as early as 300 B.C. However, the existence of those councils, the fixation of the canon that far back, Western scholars have their fingers crossed on. The fact is that Northern, roughly speaking, Northern Buddhism, the less orthodox by Western standards, is less concerned about textual criticism, about maintaining a canon of the Bible, that is, of their Buddhist Bible, whereas the Southeastern are sedulously careful about every syllable, and they're the ones who have kept intact the Buddhist scriptures in a way that the Northerns have not bothered. We have to make a decision. And the decision that I make is in favor of Pali Buddhism, using this as the standard. Just as we did, we made a decision in terms of the four castes, each one of whom, of course, this is in Hinduism, has its own tradition. And we chose the Brahmin as the best and most authentic. The Pali canon of the Buddhist Bible has three divisions to it, three traditions. They are called, and this is familiar Buddhist language, the three baskets. And the figure is a good one, because what do you do with a basket? You carry things from one place to another. That's what these three baskets have done. They carry the vintage or the food or whatever you put into a basket from its source, from its roots, to where it is eaten or consumed, except the eating and consumption here is spiritual. I think when you can use that for tradition. In fact, the words Tipitaka, that is the Pali words for tradition, are also the words for baskets. There are three of them, each of course with a conglomeration of scriptures. The one set has to do with what the disciple ought to do and describing his obligations. This is called the Vinaya, V-I-N-A-Y-A. I'm not sure, but I think much of this will be in the notes that I hope you will get soon. The second set of baskets or traditions have to do with the discourses, mainly, of course, of Buddha or of Buddha's immediate disciples, corresponding roughly to the sermon texts of Christ in the New Testament. They are called Sutta, S-U-T-T-A. But in a way, the most important and that on which we mainly base our understanding of Buddhism, the rest is rather descriptive, is the third, the doctrine, or better perhaps, corresponding to the Upanishads. And by the way, this third part does come last chronologically in its production, is the Abhidhamma, A-B-H-I-D-H-A-N-N-A. The principal authority, or better, the principal source of our knowledge for what Buddha actually taught is the Sutta, or the purported discourses that he spoke. Now you see the different climate here immediately from Hinduism. You have a person, you have a great leader, charismatic no doubt, a man who from the very beginning drew a great following after him, a man who met opposition, as all the drama with it is origins, and therefore they would put down with whatever degree of accuracy we don't know what he said. They deal mostly, that is, the discourses of Buddha deal mostly with the Dharma that we talked about. Remember? The law, the way of life that the Hindu is supposed to observe, except here the term is Dharma, and just to get our etymology straight, because it is of some moment, Dharma is Sanskrit, Dharma, D-H-A-N-N-A, instead of D-H-A-R-M-A, is Pali. And this will keep coming up constantly. For example, when we reach Nirvana, that is when we reach talking about Nirvana, that is the Sanskrit terminology for majority Buddhism. Nibbana is the Pali. And often the words are quite same. The liturgy is not unlike. But you can get confused in many cases. Most sources, depending on which they favor, will give you in parentheses either the Pali or the Sanskrit equivalent. What is this Dharma, to distinguish it from the Hindu Dharma? It may be variously synonymized, and hence we get into some of the ambiguities now of Buddhism. It may be spoken of as the rule of the deity, or the rule prescribed by the deity. But when you use that language, you are talking about one type of Buddhism, namely theistic Buddhism, because a certain amount and much of southern or southeastern Buddhism is not, at least obviously, theistic. In other words, they quite dispense with the deity who would stand behind them over law. Or it may mean this Dhamma, social obligation, where there is indeed some kind of authority, but the authority is imposed not by a transcendent being, which is theism, but by society. Or again, it may be identified, and again depending on the sect in Buddhism, simply with law. And there, of course, it would be that which is somehow structured by the society in which the person lives. Or again, and finally, especially in Chinese Buddhism, which tends to be more mystical, more reflective, Dhamma may be any reality which deserves to be understood. Well, then it's presumed that in the degree to which I understand something, it will somehow impose upon me its corresponding moral obligations. Outside of the Pali canon, there is a mass of literature which may be called, but I think mistakenly, scripture. Yet, it never gets attention because it is the source of so much of popular Buddhism. Now, this is more true, I think, than it was regarding Hinduism. First, because the scriptures of Hinduism are more vague. What is scripture in Hinduism? That's a good question. What is it? Well, anything which somehow belongs to the Vedas. Well, what are the Vedas? Whereas in Buddhism, scripture is pretty well identified. In other words, it is somehow identified with the historical personage who came and went. In other words, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to the scriptures of Buddhism, not so with Hinduism. You begin to see some analogy with our Christian scriptures. And as a consequence, it is more easy to say what is not scriptural or biblical for the Buddhists, certainly by Pali standards, inasmuch as whatever was not or cannot be authentically attributed to Buddha or to one of his immediate followers as carrying on his tradition can scarcely, except by an extension of language, still be called Buddhism or Buddhist Bible rather. There is also a collection. Now this connection, I hope the name is in your notes. It's called the Nikaya, N-I-K-A-J-A. This purportedly contains most of Buddha's writings, now this along with another document, also not in our sense biblical, but quite post-biblical, the Yataka, J-A-T-A-K. These are the birth tales describing the birth of Buddha. Why are these two collections important? They are important because they are the principal arsenal of those invidious comparative religionists who find in Buddha the perfect parallel for Jesus Christ. Well, so what? So it makes all the difference in the world when the Nikaya and the Yataka were written. They are certainly post-Christian. And when I read, as I do in any number of comparative religionist textbooks, takes for example, Noss, I think the spelling is N-O-S-S, and I think the title is The Religions of Man. It is perhaps the most popular comparative religion textbook used in the United States. I suppose 100 colleges and universities use the book. In fact, having somewhat steeped myself in comparative religion and then wondering where I would find time to write a book about it, once I read Noss, I said, somebody's got to write the book. And I spent many hours of many nights pounding a typewriter. Noss spends pages drawing on these two sources, discrediting Jesus Christ as just another great man, no doubt, but certainly not what Christians claim. And you get all the details because the Yataka tales have of a virgin birth, of magi, of shepherds, even a crib. And of course, he doesn't say the Yataka tales are known to have been written in the early Middle Ages of the Christian era. As a means of discrediting Christianity, just as, and those of you that know early comparative, Roman and Greek writing in the patristic era, there are just a whole sea of knowledge that we haven't touched. When the early Greek and Roman thinkers, seeing the rise of Christianity, and of course, they panicked. Well, the emperors did their part. They killed any Christians in sight. The Roman and Greek priests and writers did their part. I would commend to all of your reading, and it's interesting reading, Origen's Contra Celsum. They're good English translations. Origen's book, writing to refute Celsus, C-E-L-S-U-S. Celsus wrote a huge book called Truth. How appropriate can you get? written about the end of the second century. We don't have the text, the complete text of Celsus, though we hope to discover it someday. But much of it is reconstructed by the quotations, long quotations, that Origen used. Celsus went right down from the first page, in fact, the first verse of the Gospels, right down the New Testament, discrediting everything in the New Testament, showing how there is a perfect counterpart for it in Greek and Roman religion. But what scholar, where, see, would you find that kind of both competence and honesty to say the Apocrypha tales are Celsus 1,000 years later? You see what I'm saying, sisters? What I'm saying is that comparative religionists who are not well disposed to Christianity will use things which they find in Christianity and will reconstruct from whole cloth. Because by this time, of course, what has happened, as you can imagine, not many of the Buddhists or people, for example, in the Orient, as Christianity spread, would adopt parts of Christianity. Or, for example, there may have been Christians who, for a variety of reasons, lost much of their Christian faith, yet retained certain elements of it. Or again, we know that Christianity in the Orient came not only in its orthodox, authentic form, as say into southern India, but also and very specially in its Nestorian form into China. And consequently, the influence, what I am saying is, the influence of Christianity on Oriental thinking was great. And that therefore there is no warrant historically for saying that what we read in the Apocrypha tales actually happened, because there is no warrant for that kind of tradition in Buddhism until after the Orient had been in contact with Christianity over 1,000 years. Does that help? These birth tales, the Apocrypha, tell, for example, among other things, about the 550 previous existences of Buddha. There is finally, we were just now talking about the writings, such as they are, on which Buddhist tradition is based, a long dialogue called The Questions of King Milinda. Milinda is M-I-L, and the rest is Linda. A dialogue purportedly between a Buddhist philosopher, it's a Buddhist philosopher and King Milinda. But the philosopher had been deeply influenced by Greek thought. In other words, this is, and this by the way was referred to by the fathers of the church. We know this goes back to about 300 or 400 AD at least. The Questions of King Milinda I have used myself as one of the clearest expressions of what Buddhism really is. It shows, by the way, the deep influence, on the one hand, of Christianity in the Orient, also in this case of Greek thought in the Orient. But when you read Buddhist writers, the influence of Buddhism in Western Europe, for that matter, Eastern Europe too. Now the life of Buddha, such as we can reconstruct from what we read about him, the lifespan of Buddha was during the period of great religious fervor. We will pick up the exact dates when we come to examine more closely the doctrine, because the dates are pretty important. That is the exact time when Buddha lived. It was also a time of great speculation and also doubts. It was, as we said before, the period roughly the 7th, 6th, and beginning of the 5th centuries B.C. We know it was a period of great speculation and also of doubt, because of the amount of literature that developed, much of which was in oral form until more lately written, which created parts of Hindu scriptures, notably the Upanishads. And the question was about man's real existence. It was concerned with the forms of worship and with asceticism, all directed, this is, we're speaking of India now, to how to escape the wheel of existence. Now, behind it, you see immediately, is an implicit immortality, which we haven't even touched on. This is never questioned. In fact, whatever else it is, the Veolian never questions, is man's continued existence. The whole question is, how does he continue? What's his state of life in this life after the present life? Many sects arose. We're speaking now of that. Let's put it into the 6th century B.C. in general. Many sects arose according to different interpretations and various leaders, the two greatest of whom were the man that we spoke about as the founder of Jainism, Mahavira, and now the founder of Buddhism. Buddhism originally was one of these speculative sects. He has many names. I'm sure these names will be in your notes. I will spare both you and me the trouble of spelling them out, except to pronounce them. His first name was Siddhartha. That was his personal name. His most popular or common name was Gautama. Now this, I will give you the spelling, it's either G-A-U-T-A-M-A or G-O-T-M-A. That was his surname. He belonged to the Kshatriya caste of the Hindus, which, as you know, is the second highest, the military, the princely caste, the born leaders. He belonged to a sub-clan or sub-caste called the Sakya clan, and therefore another name by which he is known is that of his sub-caste, the Sakya Muni. This name I think you have seen in other places besides in Buddhism. Then, and this is a name which was attributed to him by his followers, was Bhagavat, which we've seen in another context, the Blessed One, the Happy One, the Glorious One. And finally, he is also identified, again by his followers, as Tathagata, the one who has arrived, the man who has achieved. We know he was married. We even seem to be agreed on the name of his wife, Gopa. He may have had other children. We know he had one who appears in some of his dialogues, Rahula. He'll relapse into either legend or confusion. And confusion, I say, because there are so many overlapping tales and so many stories which are hard to sift out. It seems, however, that after some years of happy life, and this is emphasized, it wasn't because his wife was nagging or things were unhappy at home. No, he was happy. Yet he renounced the world and left home. There are stories about his stoicism, about his royal lineage, There are dramatic stories, some of which are found in your selections, of the efforts made by people to persuade him, and persuade him in most extreme ways, offering him wealth, women, horses, you name it, whatever the ancient Indian held dear, but with one dramatic gesture he said, "Not for me." According to the Ataka tales, they tell the story of his birth, the wonders and the efforts made to keep him from leading the world. Let me just read a few lines. Now, this, by the way, is another. As I said, for all practical purposes, all comparative religionists assume this. Christ is just another Buddha, except that he came a little later. This is the World Bible, Portable World Bible, my edition, 9th printing. When I first bought this, not this particular one, but the standard edition, which is much larger, I decided I'm going to come out with a World Bible. I hope to have it out in the spring of 68. It's a fine piece of work, but the commentary is devastating. Let me read. This refers to what we're talking about here.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.